We can turn back to the passage you read in Luke chapter 23. And we can read again at verse 42. And he said, it's the criminal, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. I suppose if somebody had said to the condemned criminal at the moment he was condemned that 2,000 years later and a few hundred miles from his location that people would be singing about him, he'd have regarded that as impossible. But there we were, singing about him. The dying thief rejoiced to see that fountain in his day, and there may I, as vile as he, wash all my sins away. Extraordinary, isn't it? That someone who was justly condemned should become the theme of songs of millions of people since then. So I just want us to think about him and see what we can learn from him. I don't know if you agree with the sentiment of Bishop Ryle. In one of his books, he's got a chapter called Christ's Greatest Convert. And if you read the chapter title, you might say to yourself, I wonder who that is. And when you look the chapter up, you find it's a dying thief. It's a long time since I read the chapter, so I can't recall the reasons why Ryle thought he was Christ's greatest convert. But there are features in his experience that are totally unique to him. I mean, he's the only believer that was beside Jesus when Jesus died. And that in itself gives him a place of real importance. I mean, if in heaven we want to ask somebody what it's like to be at the cross, well, he's the man, because he was there for all of it. And he was right at the heart of it in everything that took place. Just want to ask a couple of questions. First one is, who was he? Or what kind of man was he? And then secondly, what would he have felt like when he came to the cross, to his cross? And then what he discovered at Calvary that has made him such an inspiration for millions of people. So who was he? Well, he wasn't an everyday criminal, if there is such a person. Nor was he really a thief, although he might have stolen plenty of things. The man in the center cross, or the one who should have been there, Barabbas, that was this man's leader. And Barabbas was a revolutionary. He was an individual determined to overthrow the Roman Empire. And in ways that he didn't expect, he discovered that he was set free. But his colleagues didn't share in such good fortune. And two of them were condemned along with Barabbas, and the two of them went to the cross. So here's a man who to some people would have been a hero. He's actually fighting for the liberation of his race. But of course, to the Roman authorities, he was a criminal. And whatever they had done in the hours before they were arrested, we are told that they had committed murder. So in all probability, it was some soldiers that they had assassinated in some form. And they chose the best time to have their attempted revolution, because the Passover, well, it was an occasion for celebrating a previous deliverance when Moses had led the children of Israel out of bondage to the most powerful empire at the time, the Egyptian Empire. And no doubt these people might have thought, well, it happened in the past, it can happen again. And there's all these millions, a million Jews apparently, who go up to Jerusalem every year to keep the Passover. And there they're there, and if they follow us, then we will have our triumph. But that's not the way things worked out. Instead, they were arrested. But that's who he was. He's not a common criminal, really. He's actually a very different type of person. So what would it be like when he came to the cross? To his cross. Now, we can say he was a very driven man, can't we? This man had ambition. He had great ambitions. I mean, imagine someone trying to overthrow America or overthrow Russia. That's what this man was trying to do, way back in his time. His aim was to get rid of the Roman Empire, an empire that stretched halfway around the world. And he was devoted to doing this. He was a very driven man. He would go to great lengths to bring it about. He wasn't just content to, as it were, to sit back and dream about it. He was willing to do what he could to bring this aim that he had. So he's a very driven character. And I think we can read that in what he says at the cross. Because at the cross, we see aspects of his outlook coming out. And we'll think about them later on. So he's a very driven man. At the same time, he'd be a very disappointed man, wouldn't he? As I suggested, he had high hopes, no doubt. He expected all these Jews who were up in from all over the world to keep the Passover. He expected them to rally to Barabbas' attempt. But whatever way it happened, the Romans were able to curb the attempt, and it was finished. Here he was, hanging on the cross. His hopes had been dashed. He's a very disappointed man. When we think about him being a driven man, well, surely we say to ourselves, people who are driven can find answers at the cross. When what they are focused on doesn't happen. And people who are disappointed, whatever their dreams were, they find the answer at the cross, the same as this man eventually did. In addition to being driven and being disappointed, we can also see he was defiant. I mean, there's Jesus, the most beautiful man who ever lived. But from the point of view of this revolutionary, at that particular moment, Jesus' message was the totally opposite of what he wanted. He wanted to overthrow Rome. Jesus, in contrast to him, preached a message of peace, in which he, even as they arrived at the cross, these two men, they heard Jesus say something. And instead of showing animosity towards the Romans who were crucifying him, Jesus prayed for them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And these two criminals heard that. And as they listened to Jesus make that incredible prayer, a prayer that reveals his love, they despised him. They mocked him. For these two men, who these two men thought was a savior, initially is Barabbas. He's the man who's going to rescue us. And as for Jesus, what does his message of forgiveness bring about? And there on the cross, this driven man, this disappointed man, is a defiant man. And he looks Jesus in the face and despises him with all his heart. He mocks him, derides him. I suppose if we were a neutral, which we cannot be, but we would say to ourselves, which of the two options are going to win? The political revolutionary or the Prince of Peace? And we can see at this man, well, for him to become Christ's greatest convert, something very different. Radical has to happen. And we see that something did. Because all of a sudden, he changes his tune. And we might say, well, he changes his tune when things seem almost ridiculous. Because all of a sudden there, down in verse 39 and 40, verse 40, he responds to his former colleague as his friend derides Jesus and says to him tauntingly, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." I mean, it all depends who says words. We could say these words to somebody and mean them. But here's a man about to die. And he says to Jesus, "Save yourself and us." But they are words of contempt. But his friend, who previously had been deriding Jesus, now changes his words completely. And we know the answer to what's happened here. That in an amazing way, the Holy Spirit has shown to this revolutionary that the real power lies in this man who's hanging beside him. And he just turns to his former colleague and says, and rebukes him, and says to him, "Do you not fear God, since we are indeed under the same sentence of condemnation?" I mean, the man's a Jew. He understands that sooner or later he's going to face God and face God's judgment. And however long people could survive on the cross, and sometimes they could live for 2 or 3 days, eventually his life is going to come to an end. And he knows when that moment comes that he's going to be facing God's judgment. And when he comes to stand before God's judgment, all his efforts to recover some political dream are not going to do him any good at all as he stands there before God. And he just says to his former friend, and he's not deriding his friend when he says it. He just points out to them and says, "Do you not fear God? There's only one place you're going to from this cross. And the place you're going to is the place of judgment. It's the only thing that's guaranteed to happen." And then he points out, in addition to challenging his friend, he confesses his own sin. "We indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds." An extraordinary way of a revolutionary looking at his previous behavior. All these efforts he has made to try and recapture their national greatness, he just says about it, "We are getting the due reward for our deeds." He says to his friend, "When you and I did what we did in the last few days, they did not please heaven. And we deserve to be here on the cross for our actions." And then he turns and points to Jesus and says to his friend, This man who I was deriding a few minutes ago, this man has done nothing wrong." He doesn't mean that this man hasn't done anything outrageous. Instead, he says, "This man has never done anything wrong." That throughout his entire life, he's done nothing wrong. How did he know that? And why is that detail stressed here? Why should a convicted criminal all of a sudden start to speak about the perfection of Christ's life? And why should Luke record it for us, so that when people read it, they discover that there's something important about the innocence of the life of Jesus? It was Passover time, and maybe this man realized that what Jesus was doing, that he was fulfilling the Passover lamb. We don't know that, but maybe that's what he was doing. And he would have been aware, as a Jew, that the Passover lamb had to be flawless. There was, if there was the slightest spot in it, it was no use as a sacrifice. And it would not be too difficult for him to move from that to saying, well, if that's true of the animal that's used in the ritual, and if here, as a Jew, he probably knew Isaiah 53, and he would have remembered with the lamb being led to the slaughter, and the one who was dumb before his shearers. And as he looked at Jesus hanging there in his state of utter weakness, maybe it dawned on this man. This is the one that the prophet spoke about. This is the one who's going to be flawless and sinless. And Luke tells us that at the time when Jesus died, this individual stood up and testified to the perfection of his life. And that, of course, is a very crucial part of the Christian message. It's not enough that our Savior died for us. We need a Savior who also lived for us. When you and I get to the judgment seat, God is going to ask us two things. He's going to say to us, how did you treat my commandments? What's your obedience like? Because you're meant to give me, says God, a life of total obedience. And God never takes away that requirement. And in addition to that, I am going to have, and you as well, are going to have to give to God the payment for our sin. So when we stand there in the day of judgment, like this criminal, we're going to need a perfect life. And we are going to need an atoning death. And where are we going to get them? Because we can't give either. I can't give to God a life of obedience. Nor can I give to God any payment for any of my sins. But I need someone who can. And someone who did. And if the dying thief had known it, he'd have joined in the verse that Bonar wrote. Upon a life I did not live, upon a death I did not die, another's life, another's death, I rest my whole eternity. When God says to us, where is your life of obedience? We just point to Jesus. And we say, he lived a perfect life. And part of that perfect life included him behaving perfectly on the cross. His perfect life didn't stop when he was nailed to the tree. But how he responded after being nailed to the tree was necessary for his perfect life. And if we had been standing there with this criminal, and we heard Jesus say, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. We would say to ourselves, that's perfect. What else should he have said if he's the perfect one. And instead of taunting him for his weakness, we would admire him for his perfection. And everything else he did on the cross is just the crowning of his perfect life. And he's not just doing it for himself, but he's doing it for everyone that would trust in him, including this criminal beside him. And this man grasps that, doesn't he? He's saying to his friend, "You and I need someone who never sinned." What amazing insight he had as he gazed at a battered body hanging on the cross, the body of Jesus. And because of that, he became a delivered man. He just said to Jesus, there in verse 42, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Where did he get that from? In all probability, he had never seen Jesus before. But if you realize that the person hanging there is the perfect man, then you are bound to look at what is said about him, aren't you? And what was said about him? What's written above his head? Because that's the only information this man has got. Apart from the fact that he now knows that the one hanging there is a perfect man. And written above the head of Jesus is his name. Pilate put it there. Written there is "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." This man, this criminal, had spent his entire life looking for the King of the Jews. He's looking for someone that's going to set them free. He doesn't know when he's going to do it, but he knows when the King comes, that's what's going to happen. And as he looks at the one he now regards as the perfect man, he says, "Your name is Jesus. So that's what I'll call you. And it tells me you're a king. And I don't know when your kingdom's coming. But when it does come, remember me." He discovered, or realized, that this suffering man with a future kingdom was approachable as he was hanging there on the cross. We can say about this criminal that he used the information that he was given, and he used that information to speak to Jesus. What do we do with the information we have? Because we know so much more in comparison to him. All he had was these two little details: his name and the fact he was going to have a kingdom somewhere. And he used that to speak to Jesus. You and I, as I just said, we know a lot more than that. But what's the point of knowing it if we don't talk to Jesus about it? It doesn't do us any good if we don't talk to him about it. I'm sure that most of us have been very familiar with all the details about Jesus, and we know far more than two things. But unless we speak to him about them, our knowledge doesn't do us any good. And we should copy this man. We can even take his prayer. And even the words that he uses. They can mean far more to us than they ever did to him when he first uttered them. And we can just say to Jesus on behalf of ourselves, Jesus, remember me now that you're a king. But this man did that. And that simple, straightforward request brought him immediate deliverance. Didn't get him off the cross, which was the trivial thing he was asking for a few minutes earlier. But what it did get to him was a promise of being in heaven, which was of far more importance than being rescued from suffering for a few years. Jesus just said to him there, truly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. And of course we can see in that statement that Jesus knew where he was going. He also knew how long it would take him to get there. The Jewish day finished at 6 p.m. It's now noon. Within 6 hours, both Jesus and this man are going to be in paradise. What an extraordinary statement. It's not that some vague time in the future, perhaps even tomorrow, that we will be in paradise. But today, in the day that's got 6 hours left in it, within that time, Jesus says to him, you and I will be together in paradise. What a beautiful picture of heaven, isn't it? Paradise, a garden. A place of beauty, a place of rest, a place of joy, a place of happiness, a looking back to Eden. When Jesus spoke of paradise, he knew what he was speaking about. He didn't have to dream of pictures about what the garden looked like. He was the one who had made it way back in the beginning. And he's saying to this man, he's using the best possible picture of heaven, paradise, and saying to this man, you're hanging there in agony in this ugly location. But within 6 hours, you and I will be in the place of bliss. And we could imagine the man. He had been looking for a kind of kingdom that would have given him a few years of freedom down here. And he discovered Jesus was offering to him a permanent place of joy. joy and blessing. And I am sure that there was great comfort in his heart as he heard that. He's got 6 hours to go. What's going to happen in these 6 hours? What's this man going to go through? I mean, he's now a disciple. What do disciples go through? Is he going to be spared something? Because he's only got 6 hours to go. So what happened to him? Luke tells us. He went through an incredible time of darkness. This one that he was speaking to at noon, all of a sudden, as they were perhaps just finishing their conversation, it all went dark. And although it's not very easy for him to see what's going on, he can sense that the one hanging beside him is going through some kind of turmoil. A turmoil that's going to reach its strength 3 hours later, when this man who said to him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," now turns to God and says, "Why have you forsaken me?" What did this new disciple have to go on? As the one he had trusted in, the one he had affirmed has lived a perfect life. What's this former criminal got to rely on as he faces this darkness? Well, he can only go on the promise, can't he? Even though it's been dark for 3 hours, he can only go on the promise that within 6 hours he's going to be in paradise with Jesus. And since this perfect man never tells a lie, there's no contradiction between the promise that the criminal will be in heaven and the sense of being abandoned that Jesus is expressing. Maybe the man realized that somehow this darkness that Jesus was going through was because of all these deeds that this former revolutionary had been doing as he tried to get freedom for his people. But whatever it was, like all disciples, he went through a time of darkness in which there was a situation that he couldn't explain. And all he could do in the darkness was trust the words of the one who had suffered there beside him. And then, as a disciple, he met new converts. What new converts did he meet at Calvary? How can he possibly meet new converts at the cross? And who are they going to be? Well, the extraordinary thing is that the new converts, there in verse 42, are his former enemies. The Roman soldiers who had arrested him, and who had nailed him to the cross, who had also nailed Jesus to the cross. Here they are, the centurion and his four men. Luke tells us that the centurion praised God and certain this man was innocent. And Matthew tells us that they all praised God. And we can imagine this former criminal who's discovered who Jesus is. And there at his feet are five soldiers who've discovered who Jesus is. As a disciple, he's met new disciples. I mean, that is what happens to disciples. That's the story of their experience. And that's what happened to this man. And maybe, just maybe, because we don't know when he died, but maybe he lived long enough to see two prominent Jewish citizens making their way to the cross, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. And he sees these ones who again he would have thought little of previously, because members of the Sanhedrin, well, they were just conformists. But here they are, and these two who had kind of sat on the fence before and not fully come out for Jesus, here this soldier, if he's still alive, sees them coming. And at the cross, taking down the battered body, are these two prominent citizens. And if the soldier, if the criminal was still alive, what a strange conversation between him and the five soldiers and these two prominent Jewish leaders. I suppose we do have to ask ourselves, how do we know what happened at the cross? Who has told us all the details of Calvary? Wasn't the disciples, because they had run away. It wasn't the woman, because they're too far away. How do we know that this man made his prayer? He didn't live to announce it in the city the next day. He had to tell someone, who then told someone. And eventually it got to Luke. And we have it here in his gospel. And I suspect that when Joseph and Nicodemus came to the cross that day and discovered five praising soldiers and one converted criminal, they just told the story and repeated it. And now it's recorded for us. As we close, he died. He lived as a disciple for a very short time. But what a powerful testimony he has said. You know, none of us can possibly know what God can do with our story. What's important is that people hear it. If people don't know our story, how can they know us? and it's our responsibility to tell them, just as this man must have done. He died unnoticed on earth, didn't he? He'd have been taken down off the cross at some stage. And what normally happened to the bodies, they were just thrown on the rubbish dump. And that's probably what happened to him. But long before his body was thrown into the rubbish dump, he had entered heaven. And when he got to heaven, he was welcomed there by Jesus. And the Jesus who welcomed him into heaven will take care of his body and still die. Just close with this. I remember years ago reading a sermon by Spurgeon on the dying thief. And Spurgeon, in his own way, imagined the arrival of the thief in heaven, or the criminal in heaven. And he pictured the angels anticipating the arrival, and of them saying to one another, "I wonder what great person's going to come in after Jesus." And in comes this man. And Spurgeon has the angels turning to Jesus and saying, "Who's this?" And the answer they got, a sample of them all. Because none of us deserve to get there. And if we do want to get to heaven, we have to take our place beside this man. And no matter how much we would abhor his actions, we have to take our place beside him and say with him, "Lord, remember us when you come to your kingdom." And if we do that, we'll reach the same destination as he has been enjoying for 2,000 years. So may God bless these thoughts to us.